Today we're going to take up again Senate Bill 437. I'm going to try to organize the format for this presentation so that we can receive testimony on the proposed amendments and get a response in turn from University System. I'd like to ask Grattan Kearns to come up, be there for response, comment. I'm going to ask Committee Administrator to tell us what we have for amendments, and then we will begin to take testimony on these proposed amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've stapled to your staff measure summary all the amendments we had prior to this meeting, and then we've got a couple of more that have come in. So, briefly, the Dash 3 amendments are from the Community College Association and would exempt community colleges from the program review by the Office of Degree Authorization. The Dash 5 amendments are no longer in play and have been replaced. And those were from SEUI. The Dash 6 amendments from the Oregon Student Association, and those have been replaced as well. The Dash 7 amendments are from the Department of Justice and delete those provisions that were in the bill that would have allowed OUS to hire their own attorneys. The Dash 8 amendments are from Senator Farioli for the Oregon Independent College Association, and that deletes the provisions exempting the university system from the program review by the Office of Degree Authorization. So by deleting the exemptions, they would be back in and be reviewed by the office. The Dash 9 amendments are the new amendments from the Oregon Student Association that replace the Dash 6s. And this establishes a subaccount within the Higher Ed Student Tuition and Fees Revolving Fund for tuition funds. So those tuition funds are separate from those other fees and funds. The Dash 10 amendments are from Senator Deckert, and as I understand them, are a compromise amendment dealing with the Office of Degree Authorization and those program review. Do you want to say a few words, Senator Deckert?
Sure. The Dash 10s, which, does everyone have a copy?
No.
They're coming.
Here they are.
Thanks. And does the public have opportunity to...
There's some extras out there.
So there might be four copies for everyone to divide up amongst 50 people. The Dash 10s do three things. They're kind of in between the original bill and the Dash 8s. They set up a process where the Student Assistance Commission would review if a public institution, whether that's community colleges or higher education institution, wanted to expand. They would first notify everyone that they are looking to expand, which I think was an important point, that you get the notification. The second thing that they would do is they would allow that private institution the ability to challenge setting up a 9-month window. And that needs to be incorporated into the amendment. That's not in the Dash 10, but I would propose that be part of the Dash 10, which would be a 9-month review to do it, and it creates, instead of the adverse impact standard, more neutral standard, which reads, the program or location would have to fail to meet a public need as determined by an evaluation of the local market conditions of the area served by the program. So those three changes as a compromise, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And then the Dash 11s, which I'm handing out now, are the new amendments from the SEIU that have to do with their coverage, their health care coverage. The original bill had gave OUS the ability to use something other than PEB for their insurance. And this would put the classified employees back under PEB. And those representatives are here, and I'm sure we'll come up and talk about it more at length. Grant and suggest we take them in this order.
All righty. We will we'll be taking these somewhat out of order. We're going to start with the DOJ, and that would be the Dash 7 amendments. And invite Attorney General Hardy Meyer to come up. And
Mr. Chairman, Greg and Karen, for the record, representing the Oregon University System, and you have in your packet a letter from the Attorney General to Chancellor Richard Jarvis and a letter from Chancellor Richard Jarvis to the Attorney General in which they agree on a process which would obviate the need for the bill as amended, bill as printed, and we would then support the Dash 7s. So we're here to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General. Indeed, I very much appreciate the opportunity the Chair gave the Chancellor and me for further conversation around the concerns that I had raised over the provisions that would completely remove the university system from any relationship to the Attorney General in terms of control of legal advice flowing to the system under Chapter 180 and exempt the system completely from any legal sufficiency review of contracts. And instead, we have agreed that the better course policy-wise would be for the system, two things. First, for the system, the extent it believes certain classes or types of contracts should not be subject to legal sufficiency review, to request exemption from that process under the existing procedure that the legislature put in place in 1997, vested the Attorney General with the responsibility to make that determination. And then secondly, for the system and the department to enter into an interagency agreement that would be designed to try to assure that in each instance of the need for legal services, particularly around transactions, that there would be procedures spelled out which would avoid unnecessary delay or redundancy, and that would be intended, that would ensure good, clear communications at all time, and that would be intended to bring the review process to a conclusion as rapidly and as efficiently as possible. And as I said, Mr. Chair and members, and as the correspondence reflects, the Chancellor and I have agreed that these two approaches would be good policy to follow for the two departments in place of the amendments, or rather the provisions that would be amended by the Dash 7s.
Thank you. Questions? No question. Very good. I'm going to... Did I start this as a work session? I intended. Let's move into work session, and I would like an up and down vote on those Dash 7 amendments.
So move, Mr. Chairman, that we incorporate the Dash 7 amendments into the bill.
The Dash 7 amendments have been moved by Senator Farioli into Senate Bill 437. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And we will move on then to Dash 9, OSA. I didn't...
Chair Starter, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Melissa Unger, the Oregon Student Association Legislative Director, and the Dash 9 amendments replaces the Dash 6 amendments that we brought forward before you at the public hearing. And all it does is it simply creates a subaccount that tuition would then go into. It's separate from the other funds in the Higher Education Tuition and Fees Revolving Fund. We feel that this will clarify the fund, and as we're still opposed to any elimination of expenditure limits on tuition, that's an issue that's going to be dealt with in within Ways and Means, and so we're just carrying this fund over to Ways and Means, and this subaccount will just clarify that tuition is separate from other funds in the account that don't have expenditure limits on them. So it's simply that.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Grattan Cairns again. The university system is supportive of that amendment. It would clarify that the tuition payment account would be separate, and then the policy decision would run to that account only, as opposed to these funds being submerged in a larger question. So we think this would be a good thing to do, and the Ways and Means Committee, in its wisdom, will decide that, and it'll be a straight up and down policy decision on this account, and we think it would make an addition to the bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I enthusiastically move dash 9 to Senate Bill.
Senator Marsette has moved the dash 9 amendment to Senate Bill 437. Discussion. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We've moved the dash 9 amendments and the dash 7 amendments. Now we're coming to the dash 11 amendments.
Take an easy one first.
Good afternoon. For the record, Rich Peppers with the Service Employees Union, SEIU Local 503, and we have worked with Oregon University System on coming up with the Dash 11 amendments. Would describe them as our concern with the original bill was that there is a danger of adverse selection around the public employees benefit system, with a whole group of employees being taken out of the PEB system, and cost containment being a concern for PEB and for the whole state. We felt that, on the other hand, that significant legitimate concerns were raised around particular faculty, but other non-classified employees as well. And the Dash 11 amendments simply state that classified employees would continue to be covered through PEB unless a similar level of benefits and lower cost plan could be found. But for all others, that moving outside of PEB would be fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing Association of Oregon Faculties. Association of Oregon Faculties is that an association of faculty throughout the system. They're not a collective bargaining unit, but an association. And we strongly concur with the amendment. Faculty are, in fact, a very unique group within the state university system. We have seen over the years a move away from those values or those benefits that faculty have enjoyed and we believe are unique to their particular employment. So this allows the state system to stay for faculty within BEB or to, in fact, go outside and while leaving the classified within that system, and so we support the amendment.
Thank you. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Grattan Cairns again. The system was happy to have the SEIU come forward with this as an amendment. We did study it and came to the conclusion that we can be very supportive of it. It would be a beneficial amendment to the bill, and we would support the Dash 11s to do, as Mr. Nelson said, on the one hand, allowing us to move those outside the classified ranks to another health plan if the system decided that that was in the best interest of those class of employees, but would satisfy the interests of those in the bargaining units representing the classifieds that they would maintain the status quo that they have enjoyed under the Senate Bill 271, the original Higher Education Administrative Efficiency Act, and maintains our obligation to them under that act, and it runs unamended. So we would recommend the Dash 11s to you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Ferrioli.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's a recognition of a situation here, and if I understand these amendments correctly, if the same level of benefit can be maintained, then the system is free to go ahead and make the change as long as the same benefit level is maintained, if the cost is lower. But clearly, we're also acknowledging that if the cost can't be lower, and there are finite dollars in the system, it may mean faculty or classified employees that leave the system to maintain that benefit level. So as long as folks understand what we're doing here, then I have no objection to this amendment.
Thank you very much. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would...
Senator Deckard.
Thank you. I'd move the Dash 11 amendments to Senate Bill 437.
Senator Deckard has moved the Dash 11 amendments to Senate Bill 437. Further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. I overlooked a promise made, and I'm going to have to back up here. Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries wanted to testify on the Dash 7 amendments, and I overlooked that because I didn't have a note in my hand. So, Harvey, tell us why you object to the Dash 7s, please.
Thank you, Chair Starr, members of the committee. Handout. For the record, I'm Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries. We have 27,000 members and employ over 320,000 of our state's private employees. As original requesters and part of the work group that was assigned to come to consensus on the Dash 7 amendments, we would urge you to reconsider the amendments you just passed. Brought forward by the Attorney General and the university system. It does not represent the input of AOI or provide concrete resolutions to our problems. You'll see before you this document is being handed out. On the front page, Oregon has a problem with the tech transfer process. According to the Chronicle of Higher Education, there's fewer startup companies, dramatically less income from licenses, less licensing per research dollar, fewer startup companies formed out of the university system, and fewer inventions patented per $1 million invested in research than the top 10 average universities. On tab 2, you'll notice that this letter dated June 20th of last year, in which this is not a signed copy, but it is exactly like the signed copy that all the presidents brought forward to the board, the Higher Education Board. They identify that the AG's office's oversight is a major factor causing problems with access and quality to deteriorate. And they state within this letter, without significant changes in the financing, governance, and regulation of higher education, access and quality will deteriorate. It's not possible to maintain the status quo. Later in the letter on page 2, which you'll have highlighted there at the top, they also state that although each president would wish to pursue the directions in the proposal he or she prepared, we all agree that in order to accomplish these goals, the following changes must be made in financing, governance, and regulation. And they include, on page 3, that institutions should have the full management responsibility for legal and financial issues related to contract and grants, research and technology transfer activities, and intellectual property rights. Also, the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, along with the presidents, has identified this as a problem. On your second tab, you'll see that this group, which was enacted last session to tell us how to improve our economic development potential in the state, brought back a report to you saying that one key element is to streamline state-level review of research and technology transfer agreements and bring into alignment with the best practices nationwide. They thought that university contracts should be exempt from legal sufficiency review by the Attorney General. This was a very clear in the original bill, which was signed on to by a majority of legislators. And while I think it's great that our government agencies can get along, their proposal does not meet a concrete solution to our problem. Our problem being that we have a tech transfer process that does not meet market demands. The college president self-identified this as a problem. Independent counsel that was set up by the legislature identified this as a problem. And the solution we have is a review process and a potential interagency agreement. And my fear is that if the -7 amendments are allowed to stay in, that there will be no concrete resolution to this problem. If the -7 amendments are taken out, I believe we'll have proper impetus to continue our discussions and to get to a resolution that all parties can be happy with. I don't think this should stop the bill from being moved. I think these negotiations can continue on regardless of it. So I thank you for the opportunity to come back up and honoring that.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Ferrioli.
The issue, as I understand it, has to do more with legal sufficiency of the language. And I guess the question I'd have to ask Mr. Myers would be, isn't the Attorney General the attorney of record in any of these instances where there might be liability that arises from the lack of sufficiency in the language? Aren't we on the hook for the issue in terms of legal sufficiency and lawful intent and enforceability of contracts, the elements of contracts, and other issues?
Mr. Chair, Hardy Myers, Attorney General. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, then I find that as long as we're going to have the liability to take the AG out of the question of legal sufficiency is irrational. So I'm not persuaded that that is the solution. I am concerned, however, that the object of these contracts, which is the licensing of intellectual properties, really isn't currently responsive to market conditions. And I'm assuming that the compromise, and perhaps I was wrong in my assumption, I'm assuming that the compromise focuses on the questions of legal sufficiency and leaves the other issues of negotiating intellectual agreements and pursuing a better track record in licensing, technology transfers, and so forth would be the purview of the Oregon University system, but that the Attorney General's purview would be still remain the sufficiency of the language within the contracts rather than their object or their intent.
Chair Starr, Senator Ferrioli, yes, I think that's essentially correct. I say essentially because I think that the question of the intent of an agreement is something that legal sufficiency review is intended to make sure is clear.
Lawful purpose.
Yes. Right. But I've distributed to the members in my in earlier correspondence the administrative rule in which the Department of Justice has set forth the actual elements of that are covered by legal sufficiency. I don't know if the members have had a chance to look at those or not, but there's one I want to draw your attention to particularly, and that is something that is not covered by legal sufficiency review, so that's very clear. Approval for legal sufficiency does not include a determination that the public contract is a good business deal for the agency, weighing relative risks and benefits, although the Assistant Attorney General reviewing the public contract may provide advice regarding significant risks and issues in any particular transaction. The agency remains responsible for risk assessment and the decision whether to proceed with the public contract, despite exposure to the public. So I don't think there's any question but that insofar as the issue of assessing whether from a risk standpoint a transaction should occur or not occur, that that's the responsibility for the government to make and not for the Attorney General. The very purpose of the interagency agreement that I mentioned to you underlies the joint recommendation of the system and the department for the Dash 7 amendments is to achieve the kind of streamlining that has been mentioned in the just previous testimony as a goal that rightly we want to pursue with respect to the consideration of these kinds of transactions. That kind of streamlining can be accomplished within the existing legal structure, I can assure you of that. And it certainly doesn't require a complete exemption of the system from the legal sufficiency review of any contract, which is what the print bill does. Mm-hmm. Nor does it require completely separating the system from the control over legal advice which the legislature has vested in the Attorney General under Chapter 180. Completely cutting the whole system loose from that. There is simply no connection between the perceived issue, as it's been described, and the magnitude of the change that's in the bill. And again, it's my view, and the system has agreed, that the problem, as it's been set forth, can be addressed by the two processes that underlie the Dash 7 amendments. I'm not sure I can add more to that at this point, except that that's the concurrent view of the system and the department. And perhaps, to some extent, it's a question of, for at least an initial period of time, the legislature taking a wait-and-see attitude. Put up or shut up.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up on that. I do believe that the original genius in the intergovernmental or interagency or interpresidential agreement that came from this task force on OUS was that entrepreneurialism and flexibility were desirable characteristics in trying to license and promote intellectual properties. And so the attempt to make the system more responsive and less hidebound is, I think, what's at the heart of that issue. Concurrent with that issue is the question of who has liability and who has the responsibility for legal sufficiency. And if the state of Oregon has the ultimate liability for insufficiency, then at least the state's chief legal officer, the Attorney General, should have a role in that oversight of legal sufficiency, because part of their job is to protect the state from liability. So I guess I don't see these things necessarily as mutually exclusive. I guess I need to hear more about how the issues that Mr. Matthews brought forward about entrepreneurship, a less hidebound approach, more flexibility, are going to be addressed by this agreement between OUS and the Attorney General. I've already heard from the Attorney General how the issue of liability and oversight are going to be connected, and I'm persuaded by that. But I guess I'd like to hear the other issue addressed, which is Mr. Matthews' issue.
Chair Starr, if you'd like, I can take a shot at that. But you have in front of you a letter from Chancellor Jarvis dated March 12. On the first page in the fourth paragraph, it says, and if I may, Mr. Chairman, to begin the work on the two documents, which the Attorney General has referenced, we've agreed OUS will advance to you. I've instructed Mr. Ben Rollins, Chief Counsel for the OUS, and a Special Assistant Attorney General, I might add, appointed by and in direct line authority of the Attorney General, to convene an OUS work group on each immediately. The contract's exemption request governing business practices involving OUS economic development activities in intellectual property, technology transfer, new business spinoffs, equity ownership issues, and other entrepreneurial activities will begin immediately. And I can say that Mr. Rollins has begun that work. So if the Dash 7s remain and we maintain the status quo, then, Mr. Chairman, Senator Farioli, there would be an agreement between the Attorney General and the agency to begin on an exemption process, generally government, but agreed to by the Attorney General under the principles that he would find to be acceptable. I think that would then allow the university, I don't know what we'd say, put up or shut up. We would say that would then allow us to begin advancing towards those entrepreneurial activities that we're all concerned with. And I don't disagree with Mr. Matthews, don't disagree with the OCED, don't disagree with the work that went into the ballot measure 10, which was adopted a year ago, and trying to drive us forward on the economic development issues that are key, but at the same time not simply divorce a state agency from any legal oversight by the state's chief legal officer. I hope that encompasses it, Mr. Attorney General. That's where we'd come from.
Follow, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ferrioli, yes.
I guess there's a couple of things that I think are inevitable. One is that either the flexibility that's needed is evident by the performance improvement that we see in licensing and the development of intellectual properties and their connection to the business community or not. And that's going to be painfully evident in a relatively short period of time, because the objective of this whole exercise in streamlining the licensing of intellectual properties is to connect the business community with the academic community. And if that connection doesn't happen, if the impediment is still evident, it'll be evident very quickly. So I guess the issue that Mr. Matthews brings forward has a sort of an organic timetable in it. If it doesn't work, everybody's going to know, and the benchmarks will prove it. You know, they're measurable. The question of the agreement between Oregon University System and the Attorney General is certainly a matter of procedure that needs to be prescribed, but the object of that agreement is to produce a tool that connects with the business community, and they're not convinced that, you know, that there's going to be enough movement to make licensure happen and to remove obstacles and to become less hidebound and more entrepreneurial. So I guess I would suggest that in the spirit of moving this bill forward, that we maintain the -7 amendments in the bill, but expect that there's going to be connections between the business community and the OUS system, and perhaps Mr. Myers doesn't need to be involved in that discussion, as the bill moves forward, so that we can get a better idea of how this working group between the university presidents and the OUS system and the Attorney General will actually play itself out. I mean, I think the business community needs more assurances that there's going to be change sufficient to make these licensing agreements less difficult, more flexible, more readily available, and be done in a much more timely manner. And that's certainly not in the -7 amendments. It may be in the working group, a product that comes forward, and that's a condition subsequent. So I'd ask, how will the university system involve the business community, who is in fact the object of doing this, that connection with the business community?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ferrioli, that's exactly the intent of the idea of convening an interinstitutional work group, drawing on the business interests that the campuses are working with, those who've shown interest in this issue, and present in rapid order a document to begin the process with the Department of Justice over granting an exemption, giving that greater flexibility, greater entrepreneurial range of movement to the OUS, but within the family of state agencies and with a direct link to the Attorney General's office. And as you said, it's a matter of, you know, the proof will be in the pudding. You will see that, I hope, before the session adjourns. That would be a good thing. But more importantly, you'll meet again, and the indices will be there. You can take a look at them and see whether there's been productivity, whether it has worked satisfactorily, and we'll all be, not just Attorney General, the university system itself will be on the line to demonstrate that we did make the forward motion that we thought this action would permit. So in that regard, I think we're going to be very accountable on how the process works, and it's our hope that the process would work fairly directly.
Mr. Chairman, just in conclusion, the issue is that the agreement that was signed by most of the university presidents in the OUS system is to address missed opportunity. And that's the whole objective of this, is to get those licenses, licensure agreements, and entrepreneurial issues and intellectual properties out into the world of business where they can create value and add value. So, I mean, the whole objective of that agreement is missed opportunity, and I'm hoping we're not just perpetuating a situation of missed opportunity. But it seems to me there may be an empty chair at that work group table, and that would be those folks that are engaged in entrepreneurial development of intellectual properties. And if they're represented by Associated Oregon Industries or another group, Association of Electrical Engineers. I mean, I don't know who that group might be, but I certainly think that they ought to be engaged at least to help pilot the university system toward better and more facile agreements for intellectual properties. So I think there's an empty chair at the table, Mr. Chairman, on this working group.
Thank you. And
Mr. Chairman and Senator Farioli, the business interests who have brought the bill and those who are involved in this area would be, of course, consulted with this, and that was our intention, as I said earlier in my testimony, so that Mr. Rollins, in bringing together an interinstitutional work group, would have those individuals available to them for their advice and support as that went forward.
Yeah, with all respect, I understand that the university system is at a crossroads, and I fear that we're putting new wine in an old wineskin, so to speak. This has been a problem for many years and has bubbled up to the surface over the last 5 years at least, and finally has a vehicle, a rather large vehicle, to implement this giant change. And my fear is that if the Dash 7 amendments are continue to be adopted, there won't be the opportunity for that organic oversight. There's, as you know, there's a few opportunities every session for major policy change within agencies. This represents that opportunity. And so I think the policy decision before us is what is going to influence that policy change with tech transfer the best. Is that to move the Dash 7s or to wait on them and see the product that is produced by this working group? And I would like to continue your oversight in this matter and make sure that all parties are sufficiently convinced that this problem that we've had for many years is going to be rectified.
Thank you very much. I do appreciate the testimony, and I think that having it on the record, also Senator Farioli's comments, it is evident that it's has risen in the eyes of the legislature as an important issue, and we expect that this will, in fact, facilitate what we're attempting. So I'm not going to ask for Senator Deckard would like to make a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's on the same point. Senator Farioli basically made my points for me, but my hesitancy with the Dash 7s are best encapsulated with conversations that I had, and I was not a direct driver on them, but from ORTDA, and I've talked to the Attorney General about this and been I think it was helpful to have those discussions on whether it was Oregon Resource and Technology Development Account or some of the tech transfer issues we had at the university level. To me, those were probably one of the things I liked most about Senate Bill 437, or at least personally, and it's partly just the numerous conversations I had sat in. And so that's where I feel discomfort with these Dash 7s, is that in some ways I look at the OCAD report, which I was a member of, and I think we're not achieving one of our primary objectives, or, I don't know, primary, one of the objectives that we had set out. So I guess my question is in this work group, and I honed in on the March 12th letter from the Chancellor to the Attorney General, because I thought that line, paragraph 4 really is the heart of this, is this work group. I don't know if there's a timetable, but it would certainly give me great comfort, just speaking for myself, if the work group had some sort of a product on these two issues, and I'm only speaking probably more for ACAD and myself on this one, which is a private sector-led group on this issue. If in the next couple of months we might have some sort of resolution to these issues, and I don't know if that's feasible, but it certainly would give me comfort to know that we're still here in this building a couple months from now, which I think we probably will be, and able to at least come back to this, maybe not in this exact form, but those of us who heard this issue. And I don't know if that's a possibility for the universities or for the Department of Justice that they might consider.
Yeah, Chair Starr, Senator Deckard, I certainly think that that's at least an initial product which could give you some picture of what the direction is that's involved here would be possible within the time you're specifying. We'll certainly make every effort to accomplish that. And I think, too, that this this discussion that we're talking about undertaking pursuant to the agreements between the Chancellor and me, I think will also be helpful in informing the Department of Justice exactly what the views are about the diagnosis of the problem. Because if there's one party that's been substantially excluded, I think, from developing this diagnosis, which you will have to admit I think isn't very case-specific, it's kind of general, I think it's the Department of Justice. I don't think we've really been in those conversations that have occurred within the system or between the system and private enterprise. And I think that I think this process, Senator Deckard, that we're talking about here is going to be very helpful in getting out onto the table exactly what the contended diagnosis of the problem is, and give the department a chance to react to that as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckard, many of us in this committee are co-sponsors in this legislation, and I, not speaking for any of the other members, would certainly want to follow the progress of the working group and follow this bill across the building to the other chamber. And if I don't see evidence that the working group's product is successful and hear back from the entrepreneurial and business community that it isn't serviceable, I'll certainly be making that testimony in the House.
Thank you, Senator Farioli, and thank the witnesses here. We're not going to re-examine the vote by which we included the dash sevens at this time, and we're going to go on to the dash three amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ram Nivens. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association, and I testified actually on the Dash 3s in the first hearing on 437. And just to remind you, basically what they would do is add community colleges to Section 1, or essentially allow us or takes away from adverse impact office degree authorizations authority over community colleges, including with the university system.
Mr. Chairman, Grattan Cairns again. For the record, the university system is in full agreement with the Dash 3s and would accept them as a friendly amendment to the Senate Bill 437.
And I would just add that if we end up adopting Senator Deckard's amendments, we would have to marry these two together a little bit. We would.
I'm not sure of that. And as I read the dash 10s, they would, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think the dash 10s would simply amend the office degree authorization charge, but would leave both community colleges and us subject to it if you were to adopt the 10s and not the 3s.
The 10s get you
halfway.
You don't, if you get the 10s, you don't need the 3s.
If you get the 3s, you don't need the 10s.
Yeah, I realize that.
We're for the tens. We're for the threes.
We would prefer the threes as well.
I think there are some other folks who...
There will be other testimony.
Yeah.
It's the chair's belief that they can both work together, that we could, in fact, adopt both, and that they would still work for the system higher ed and community colleges, but it still leaves you within the modified...
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to disagree with you, but I'm afraid I'd have to, because the dash threes impact would take both the community colleges and the Oregon University system out from under the Office of Degree Authorization Program Approval process and, in effect, repeal it outright. There would be no one subject to it after we came out. So it would then go away under the dash threes. Under the dash tens, we would remain under the Office of Degree Authorization, but the process by which programs would be evaluated and impact would be assessed would be changed. It would be a different and more specific and, frankly, probably a little, I'd argue too strongly for them, but would make them less ambiguous and more factual in their impact, thus allowing them to be more easily assessed. And I think that would be the impact of the tenants. It would be a helpful amendment in an area that has been a problem to the university system and community colleges for many years, and would be a half step between the dash threes and leaving us the status quo, which is represented in the dash eights. So you have the threes on the one hand, the tens on the other, and the tens in the middle and the eights on the other side.
The community colleges would not be included in the dash tens, are they?
Yes, they would continue to be covered by that. Yes,
Mr.
Chairman.
Yeah.
Oh.
That would leave the present Office of Degree Authorization Program approval process in place, but alter the standards by which they would approve.
They would be covered.
Three eights and tens.
Yeah. All righty.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Just that simple, Mr. Chair.
Further questions, comments?
Might want to have the discussion on the dash eights before we actually adopt them.
Okay. We got dash 8 amendments that may provide some conflict, and we would remove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Gary Andine, the Executive Director of the Oregon Independent College Association. We appreciate the opportunity to address the Dash 8 amendments and probably the Dash 10 and the Dash 3 as well. This is a process that has been engaged in place now for 6.5 years. It was negotiated by all the parties, the public institutions and the private institutions, and resulted in a set of rules that you have before you. I just passed them out. It's a single page, series of steps, 1 through 12. Almost every step has a 15-day limit on it. And I checked with the Office of Degree Authorization and the director, Alan Contreras, and I asked Alan, in 6.5 years, how many times has this process been exercised and how far has it gone? He can't remember. He thinks it's less than a dozen times that anybody has raised any kind of concern about any program posted by a community college or a public university. And only once can he recall any of this going past step three. The process is to, if there is a concern, a seemingly detrimental impact of some kind, or a potentiality of a substantial adverse impact, then a private institution or an institution, a public institution in another sector, has 15 days to say something. If nothing is said in 15 days, the process is finished.
If they do say something in 15 days, then the proposing institution has 15 days to get back to anybody who's concerned and say, let's get together and have a conversation about this. In every case except one that Mr. Contreras can think of, that was the end of it. The conversation ended the concern. In one case, it went beyond all the way up to the point where the office was prepared to appoint a mediator, and at that point, the concerned institution backed away and said, we won't carry it any further. We think the process works well. We think that on the rare occasions, after hundreds of programs have been proposed by the community colleges and state system in the last 6.5 years, that fewer than a dozen times has anybody said, let's at least talk about what that program might do to an existing program or institution. That's a good process, and it does result in the state system and the community colleges having to at least be aware of the fact that there may be other providers out there in the neighborhood. And it does provide an opportunity for the two institutions to at least have a conversation. The fact that anybody would not want to have that makes me very nervous. And I would hope that you would adopt the -8 amendments and take these two sections out of the bill and leave the process in place the way it is, because I think it works very well. Thank you.
Questions? Mr. Chairman, Grant and Ferrance, for the record, you're in receipt of a letter dated March 14, signed by the Chancellor and by the Commissioner of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. It's got attachments there that list some of the principal examples that we've had in recent years. Won't go through them all, but more importantly, you have a paper titled, that's attached, Market-Based Higher Education and State Regulation, Competing Values and Planning for the OUS Future. And I think it's important that we recognize what's really at issue here. I think 6 years, 10 years, 12 years, 25 years ago, when the university system found that 75% or better of the construction budget was a state appropriation and we were a state agency in all aspects and intents, that may have been necessary in good language when we are now at 19% of our combined budget in state support. It frankly doesn't meet the test. That's number one. And number two, we find ourselves on the one hand being told, be entrepreneurial, be market sensitive, be student focused, be externally oriented to meet the market and do the rest of those things, but don't do it unless everyone agrees that it's okay for you to do it and that you meet it in a less than timely fashion. We think there is a value difference there. And so I think the -3s would cure a problem that continues, and the -8s would move us back to the status quo and leave us in a place where we would still be having to go through this bureaucratic process in order to do what other vendors, public and private, in the state of Oregon, and the United States of America, and in the developed nations of the planet, are able to do within the borders of the state of Oregon without anybody's permission. So, it's your choice. You know, you want us to be entrepreneurial, you want us to reach out, you want us to be market-focused, you want us to be student-centered, or adopt the -8s and say no. So that's the values. The middle ground between those, are, of course, are the -10s presented by Senator Deckard, and you have fielder's choice on those. But we think that there is a difficulty here that of those contending values, and the policy choice will be yours. The one thing I will say is that Mr. Andine is correct that the one institution did not seek to go forward. We have a policy in which we have come to a conclusion that we think that foisting onto the lay members, unpaid commissioners of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, who adjudicate program placement and extension between public and private institutions of higher education in Oregon, is an inappropriate burden to have given them by law. We opposed it at the time. And we just think it's just terribly unfair to try and burden them with that adjudication process and have not availed ourselves of it. Probably won't in the future. I'm not sure that's meaningful that we haven't gone there, because as a rule, we just don't think it's appropriate for them to have been given that responsibility. It's an unfair burden, and we think it's a mistake to ask them to adjudicate those things. And we are, of course, will be guided by your wisdom, Mr. Chairman. Among the three is the 18th.
The other question from the committee. I think there was a few of us that had really latched on to that communication that you referred to. Might be appropriate that you would mention some examples if you happen to have that.
Mr. Chairman, yes. They are, and I'll provide this copy to the committee. We have question of the Masters of Music. I'll just go in chronological order in the way they're presented at PSU. We had a problem with the PSU wanting to begin a Masters of Music. It was objected to by a member of the association who had a moribund program, but they objected anyway. SOU's Accelerated Baccalaureate Program, OIT, BS in Applied Psychology, a plan to offer bachelor's completion program and grants passed in Medford by SOU. OSU plans to offer selected degree programs statewide. I would parenthetically say we have had so far a standoff, and maybe the best word to use would be truce, regarding the extension of OSU to its branch campus in Bend, but that is not concluded yet. We hope that it remains in the dormant stage that's in now. 1998, EOU and Western Governors University, a combination of three universities, and Lamet's objection to a new master's program in accounting, environmental science and natural resource management at Mount Hood Community College by OSU. There are many, many others. So we've had lots of them. The other thing that's attached to that is the fact that we are facing a plethora of competitors here in the state of Oregon who can come in. They continue to be authorized by the Office of Reauthorization. That's quite all right. But consider the fact that the university system is really operating not just inside territorial fences, but also in pitch blackness. Because we may not know of a program extension in our bailiwick until the advertisements appear in the local newspaper, brochures are gone, outreach commences, and we find, aha, here's someone who come into our backyard attempting to provide a service. We had no notice, did not know it was going there, and have nowhere to go to say anything about it, and would like to have the very same similar kinds of ability to operate the market as do our competitors. So, as I say, the policy choice is yours, Mr. Chairman, members, but there is a long history of problems, and one which, if we've hit a patch here in the present where it's not has been as contentious as it has been, that could change in a twinkling, and we're left with a process that would provide us with significant detrimental impact to ourselves while trying to protect someone else.
Thank you.
A couple of responses might be in order. The chancellor himself told the legislature just a few weeks ago that over half of the costs of students' education are still being picked up by the taxpayers, and the tuitions are less than half of the cost. So I can assure you that we find the state system very entrepreneurial and very able to come in and offer a program easily if it's based simply on price. The idea of this legislation was to not drive the private sector out of providing services and to try to protect the public dollar from being spent where it didn't need to be spent. There are certainly plenty of programs, hundreds if not thousands of programs that can be offered out there that nobody is doing right now. The field is wide open. There are a lot of trees left to be cut in this forest. We just suggest that when Paul Bunyan comes through that he at least let people know that he's coming through, and if there's already somebody working cutting trees in that private section that the Paul Bunyan tree farm tree company might want to move on to some other section. I would like to see the list of concerns that have been raised here about past incidences and how they actually played out. I think it would be wise, if you do want to pursue the process further, to ask the degree administrator to come and speak with you about the process. And finally, we have lots and lots of lay boards in this state that are assigned all kinds of responsibilities to adjudicate things. And I don't think it's at all inappropriate to the Student Assistance Commission be the board that adjudicates these kinds of things, although it's never had to. At the time that the legislature placed it there, we lobbied that it be placed with the Department of Education. That also is another lay board that we thought could adjudicate these kinds of things. It was placed where it is, and it's been very effective and not abused at all in that particular lay board. So those are just some of my reactions.
Thank you.
Marcel. Grant, would you have any more faith or willingness to use the Oregon Student Assistance Commission if under Amendment 10, under that scenario? Would you back off?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Morissette, that is a very good question. That would provide us with a far higher degree of predictability by taking out some of the, frankly, impossible words that cannot be defined. In our mind, the dash threes would be first, the dash tens would be second, the bill as printed would be third, and we would resist completely the dash eight. So as a middle point, yes, that would make a very good compromise between where we wanted to be and where we would end up with the dash tens, and would take out such words as seemingly, significant adverse impact. I mean, there's a lot there, but there's not much bottom. Instead, we would have the program or location fails to meet a public need as determined by an evaluation of the local market conditions and the area served by the program or location. That's a lot closer to something which can be defined by market studies, surveys, going out, finding out, is there enough there in the market for everyone, or is this going to dry up a market and take something away from somebody else? And get seemingly and significant adverse impact out of the language. So, yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Morissette, that is an excellent question. And the university system would take the tens as our second choice over the threes.
Gary, could you respond to that?
Thank you, Senator Morissette. Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, this whole situation is about perceptions, and if there is a perceived detrimental duplication, that's what needs to be addressed. The perception needs to be sorted out, ironed out, satisfied to everybody's satisfaction. It works. Getting people to sit down and talk works. If you take the word seemingly out, then it becomes just outright detrimental duplication. And I suppose one can measure, I'm not quite sure how you measure detrimental. I think detrimental was put in there originally as also a compromise. So it's not just duplication. You have to prove detrimental duplication before you actually have a case. That's a major compromise on the part of the institution that feels that it might be abused. And the same thing with the second phrase, that there's significant adverse impact. Now, it's not good enough to just adverse impact. It's got to be significant. And some people have to sit down and talk about what that means and whether there's any way to work around it. This is a wonderful process. It's a process that we need to have more of in the state, not less of. And if you stick with the language, and I really appreciate Senator Deckard's effort to find a compromise here, but fails to meet a public need, well, when you come in with a program that the taxpayers are subsidizing more than 50% of, you can always prove that somebody else is not meeting a public need. We have to read fails to meet an unmet public need. I just think that this, at which point you have a double negative and all kinds of confusion about exactly what it is, who's responsible to prove what here. I think it's just a lot easier to leave it the way it is, quite frankly. I have some other representatives here from other from other private sectors who might want to comment, too.
Can I just ask one question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Andine, I appreciate those points, and I understand the dash, whether it's the threes, the eights, or the tens is kind of in the middle, and understand. I was trying to, at least, and I'd like to say I don't have pride of authorship, but on this one I kind of do. I was trying to find that, and I think this achieves at least some of your goals, not all of your goals, but in terms of making sure there's that conversation, ensuring a notification, which, gleaning from your first testimony, that there has to be, and I think that's a great point. Secondly, that there is that conversation, to me, and then thirdly, that there is some level of justification of a need out there, so that it gives you the Student Assistance Commission, which the dash threes would take away. You have that backstop there, and if I'm one of your members, and thinking, putting myself in their shoes, then I, if one of the publics wants to move in, and I really think, gosh, this is not a good move, and I think I can meet this standard, which to me is a more neutral, it's not that high, but it's a more neutral, I think it gives you that commission with a time-limited period to be able to go to them and set, and make the case. And so to me, I guess, Mr. Chair, that is trying to negotiate that middle ground, which I would hope might incorporate at least some of the concerns that you initially voiced.
Senator Perioli. Mr. Chairman, I've been listening very carefully to this discussion because I had come to the hearing intending to listen very carefully to the Dash 10 amendments, and I appreciate the Senator Deckert bringing the Dash 10s. When I looked at the memo that was distributed earlier, the March 14th memo from the university system, I looked at the arguments that were made in that memorandum, and I looked at all the out-of-state competitors, and I looked at all the private universities, and thought, what a rough and tumble the education system is. I had no idea. And listening to the discussion here today foreshadows a discussion that we're going to have in the Revenue Committee between banks and credit unions. I think we're going to see some of the same issues at play here. But when I looked at the list of people who had disputes that needed to be resolved, it wasn't correspondent schools or folks from down the road or out of state. It was Portland State University and University of Portland that had a disagreement that needed to be surfaced and resolved. It was Oregon Institute of Technology and programs in the OUS system that may have, in their opinion, made them less competent or less competitive. Southern Oregon University and Northwest Christian. It was organizations like University of Oregon, Oregon State University, Portland State University, and Willamette University. Now, these are the top universities in our state. These are institutions of longstanding worth, a lot of commitment, a total investment, certainly by their alumni, if, nobody else. But we've committed significant resources into this system, and what we don't want is institutions, big or small, picking each other's pockets. And that's why there does need to be a system of adjudication where people can surface a concern, even if it's perceived, do it on a timeline, do it in a programmatic way, leave off the eye-gouging and the finger-biting and all the other stuff that goes along with that in a programmatic way, and then come to conclusion. When I read through this memorandum, it was clear to me that all of these issues that had resulted in conflict were successfully resolved, all of them, in this process that we currently have. And so I guess it may be uncomfortable, and it may be adversarial initially, and it may be a difficult and emotional experience, and it perfectly describes the process that we engage in every day in this building. So I'm persuaded that there's really no reason to change the system that we have. I can see that overzealousness is a problem, and I think that that's perhaps been the hallmark of previous administrators of this program. We heard testimony that direction's changed, that we're in a period of more conciliatory discussion, and I think that may be a maturity in the system, but because it's only 6 years old. But I guess I'm persuaded that despite the efforts of trying to find the middle ground in this thing, I want these discussions to take place. I don't want the agencies to try to run over each other. I want a process that pulls people to the table and have these kinds of closed doors discussions that take place, but I want it done in a programmatic way that results in resolution. So I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'm not persuaded that the Dash 3 is the way to go. I appreciate the efforts on the Dash 10, which is a compromise. This is truly a problem in search of a solution. I don't think there's a problem here that needs fixed. I want these people to have this discussion statewide. These are not fly-by-night institutions that we're talking about that have real concerns that need to get addressed in the current process and resolved. I don't think it's broke. So I'd support the Dash 8. Well, that was met with overwhelming.
It was
silence, wasn't it, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Farioli, I appreciate your thoughtful presentation. The chair has been almost persuaded that we've moved the Dash 10.
Almost.
In fact, I think we had the votes to do that. This is a really significant piece of legislation. Very significant. And we're going to put this over one more day and have some further discussions. I have a letter from the governor's office with some concerns. We want to give some time to hear those concerns. The concerns from the governor's office came to us very late. For that reason, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 437 and move on to a public hearing on SJR 7. Do we have a witness sign up for SJR 7?
Okay.
All right.
Are you going to stay for a while?
It's my bill.
Yeah. It's your bill.
Mr. Chairman, I have a meeting at 4:30 that I need to be at. It has to do with Senate Bill 747. It's very important to me.
Is it going to last until the end of the day, or are you going to be back to vote on 509?
Mr. Chairman, I think my meeting can be finished in 20 minutes.
All right. We'll be here waiting on you.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to delay the work of the committee. I'll try to be back as soon as possible.
Thank you kindly. Appreciate that. At the moment, we're in a subcommittee of Senate Education Committee on the departure of Senator Farioli, and Jan, would you tell us, introduce us to SJR 7, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJR 7 is a companion bill for Senate Bill 437, which we've just been hearing. And it would propose to amend the Oregon Constitution to increase the amount of state general obligation bonds for higher ed projects to three times the dollar amount appropriated from the general fund. Right now, it's a one-to-one match. This bill has a prior referral to revenue. Both Ways and Means and Revenue would like to see it. I've talked to the staff, and their latest thinking was maybe we should let it go to revenue first, and then Ways and Means would catch it on the House side. Perhaps Granton would like to comment on that.
It's a good bill. Should pass. Mr. Cairns, please.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Granton Cairns, Director of Government Relations, Oregon University System, and we would concur in your comment. I don't believe there's anyone signed up to testify. There are no amendments, and we would urge the committee to advance it when you have a quorum.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No question. I think it's clear, and we're going to revenue probably.
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, and we had no objection.
Thank you. And then we have Senate Bill 509. We're opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 509. That is a little bill that the chair brought forward. And Jan, tell us why it does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 509 would direct the State Board of Higher Ed and OHSU, Board of Directors, to enter into an interstate agreement with the State of Washington to allow Oregon residents to be considered residents of Washington for purposes of tuition and fees. And that's based on whether Washington passes a similar bill that would allow Oregon students to be considered Washington residents. And this is primarily for those schools on the border near Portland, so students could go back and forth.
I believe we have a concern with OHSU. Has brought amendments. Yes, would you, Redden?
Mr. Chairman, I have some testimony which just has arrived from Mr. David McDonald. I haven't read it yet.
Maybe you could read it to us.
Well, I'd be reading it for the first time. I don't know. If I can scan it, well,
okay.
It's being distributed.
Yes.
Chairman and members of the subcommittee, for the record, Grant and Karen's Oregon University System. I scanned the testimony. Very little I can add to it. It speaks for itself. I do know, however, that I was here when the interstate agreement did expire. It expired in 2001, and we allowed it to lapse by virtue of the fact that there was a significant negative balance of payments between the two states, that I thought. There is a fiscal impact statement. I don't know whether it's reached you or not, but I think it's in the millions of dollars that when it will get to you that there was a significant balance of trade between the two states running very much against the university system and continuing. However, in reading Mr. McDonald's testimony, and he is the Director of Enrollment and Student Service for the OUS, that he would like, if we could, that institute a fair policy between the two states. We would not object. And that we would certainly want to have both systems have all of their campuses open to the Western Undergraduate Exchange, known to us, I'm sorry to say, as WUE, because right now only three of the public universities in Washington participate and all of ours do. So it's, again, a negative balance of payments between the two systems where only three of their campuses are available to our students, seven of our seven campuses are available to their students. So if the bill goes forward, reading Mr. McDonald's testimony, he would like to see it include some language which would allow for even exchange and open borders if you're going to do that under this interstate agreement. And I've just been handed the fiscal impact statement, and it says $7,800,000. It says the impact noted above represents the potential loss of tuition revenue to OUS. The key to a successful agreement would be to ensure a balance between the use by students and cost to students from the respective states. So it's, yeah, again, it would be balanced.
Representative Morissette.
Thank you. Thank you, because we did hear this bill when I was representative, and I remember the balance of payments being out of whack. And in fact, I wish Senator Deckard was here, because I think that was his bill way back when, this reciprocity opening it up. But, let me rephrase that. You say there was an agreement and there was a lapse in agreement. When did the agreement lapse?
In 2001, Mr. Chairman and Senator Morissette, it was an interstate agreement, a compact reached between Oregon and Washington, between our system and the Higher Education Coordinating Board of Washington, representing the colleges, universities there, the publics there, and the balance of payments was mounting and mounting and mounting against us as our budgets were being cut. We just said, you know, we can't defend that as a policy decision in allowing that much of our value to be transferred as a benefit out of state when the pressure was coming down on state residents. We would be certainly interested in reconstituting an interstate agreement if it were one that guaranteed there would be a uniform and fair way to balance the exchange.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I remember this discussion in the past, and I know there was a balance of payment and the reciprocity. I know school districts have a reciprocity of exchange based on numbers that are fairly equal, because the school district faces the same problem. They don't want to lose all of their students to the big district that happens. Mm-hmm. So there is that. I know it's in Lane County there is that reciprocity, and I think this would be a good idea if we can reach balance. So I guess that's the bottom line there for me.
Can you explain how the former system worked? How did we get reciprocity? Was this a granting of in-state tuition?
Mr. Chairman, yes, and I'm going to run in about two sentences through everything I know, and then I'm going to stop. I wish Mr. McDonald was here. He's not able to be with us. It is, in effect, a compact drawn between the two systems, saying that students could come at in-state tuition campuses by program, that sort of thing, and an understanding of the fact that there would be the granting of that benefit to a student who is not a resident of Oregon, getting Oregon residency rates, and vice versa. It ran for many, many, many years. I don't know how many years, but it became a greater and greater liability, and we were unable to get it recast with Washington because it was so beneficial to them. We let it expire. That's as much as I know. I'd be happy to have Mr. McDonald come and visit with you, or others visit with you who know more than I do.
Okay. Tell me why it was beneficial to them and not to the student.
Mr. Chairman, it was very beneficial for the Washington student and those who came in greater number, because they had access to all of our, you know, they had greater access and greater number. We had, in exchange, not as many students wishing to go because there were fewer places to go. Okay. As a result, it was like that. We let it expire. We remain a member of the Western Undergraduate Exchange, which covers all the WICHE state, the Western Undergraduate Compact on Higher Education. WUE is a WICHE program. And I'm sorry, I don't know
how that works.
I know what those acronyms mean. The Western Interstate Compact on Higher Education runs the Western Undergraduate Exchange. It's the 11 or 13 Western states. It allows a student to come here at no more than 150% of the resident tuition for particular programs or campuses that are not offered at home. All of our campuses are open to WUWE students from Washington. Only 3 of their campuses are available to our students. So, again, that program continues to run, and again, we have a
disproportion.
Absolutely. So we have Central Washington, Washington State, and Western Washington, and of course, the two bigs are not available to our students, whereas all of our campuses are available to them. And so it is beneficial to the student who comes here. It's not beneficial to the state of Oregon through our university system to have such a disproportionate number of Washingtonians coming against a much smaller number of Oregonians going. And we've got an obligation to you fiscally to make sure that we are husbanding the resources you give us and making sure we're getting value at it. And we just came to the conclusion that that imbalance of the payments between the states was just, we couldn't defend it to you, and we had to learn
Latin. Senator Morrison.
Are you aware of the imbalance between Washington and you mentioned Washington State as being a participant, but if a person registers at Oregon State to take the veterinary program, they'll spend 1 year at Oregon State, go 2 years to Washington State, and then come back. Now, that's going to change. Are you aware of the disproportionate tuition that's paid while they are at Washington State?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Moore said yes, and that's why that program is being extinguished.
It's a huge disproportionate.
Yeah, very huge disproportionate, and that's very advantageous to Washington State University at Pullman and disadvantageous to the Oregon student who had to pay the bill, yes. But your action has extinguished that program starting with the 2004 academic year when we phased that out with a full 4-year program at Corvallis for veterinary medicine.
Wills.
Where's Doc before I say something about that investment? I will hold my tongue on the vet school.
Mr. Chairman, we'll be happy to be of whatever assistance we can be, but I've exhausted my knowledge and guessed at some of it. So,
I would request that you check to see if there's any kind of proposal we might make where we could bring some reciprocity connection there that at least is mitigates our losses. In some respects, I think that having a student is important, even if he comes from out of state. But we, on the other hand, if we're subsidizing that student substantially, we got to wonder about how many we can take. So, I guess this is not a slam dunk. It's not a bill that's going to move today. We need to notify Senator Ferrioli's office that we're not going to be here to pass this bill today. But we can move the STR 7.
Okay. Could I just ask?
Yeah.
Did you ask for that? You asked for that information.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I took it that you wanted us to come back and give you a further evaluation of the bill and make recommendations about what sort of an interstate agreement we could, in good faith, enter into while protecting the assets of the state.
Absolutely, and if we can't find a ground where we can do that, we won't bring the bill back. That's
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Deck.
Just one thought along those lines is Senator Don Carlson from Vancouver, who's the chair, I believe, of their higher ed or their education higher ed. He's your counterpart, Senator Starr. He's very interested in this, and so every time I see him, he asks me about this issue. Mm-hmm. So we might want to contact him. I know he really wants to see us do a reciprocity agreement, and I think the question that I would put to him, but if you'd like to do it, Brad, that'd be great, is I want to be a fair reciprocity agreement. If he can move legislation, I think then we certainly could too.
Mr. Chairman, I think if you were to address him on that, that would be good. He has just been successful in getting a bill passed to incent students to complete and get their degree, to get out of the system there by virtue of the experience they're having, just like ours. And their University of Washington is about to adopt a residency requirement very similar to ours, which is one of the strictest in the United States of America, because they're beginning to experience the same kind of budget pressures we are. So I think he would tell you that he's not sure he wants a whole lot of Oregonians coming there while they're trying to bring up the drawbridge themselves. But if you can convince him of that, we'd be happy to work with him, and we will return, Mr. Chairman, and thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 509 and adjourn our Senate Education Committee this day.
Yeah.
I'm